Thank you, everyone. My name is Kate Krause. I am an AIDS activist from the US, from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, actually. I've been working as an AIDS advocate for about 20 years, and I've worked on China and human rights for about 10 of them. I'm director of an organization called the AIDS Policy Project. I'm here to talk about what happens when surveillance moves to large-scale political repression. Surveillance in China right now is like looking into a crystal ball and seeing what might happen in 5 years to everybody else. The people who know the details of China's program are either spying themselves or risk harm if they talk about it. It's interesting to note that if you want to get a computer science degree in China, you have to join the People's Liberation Army. I'm not a technical person, but I want to share with you what I have learned about these ID cards and how they're being used. This information is not comprehensive. There are a lot of gaps, and I'm hoping that some people, even in this audience or online, may be able to help fill in those gaps. China is a country with 4,000 years of history. It's an amazing place. It's got incredible history, incredible culture. There's a lot to love about China, and we're not going to talk about really any of the good stuff today. There are people, there are people who say that since the Snowden revelations, they feel like they're living in science fiction, like Minority Report. But many people in China really are. 1 billion Chinese citizens have government-issued smart cards, identification cards with a little radio antenna and a microcontroller in them. They're mandatory. You have to carry them with you at all times. And China has 500 street demonstrations every single day. People protest when their farmland is stolen by the government, which happens to 4 million farmers every year, and they fight back when the government colludes with private developers and demolishes their houses so that developers can build new high-rises on their land. And people travel hundreds of miles to Beijing to complain in person to public officials, sometimes living in the streets while they wait for their chance. Those people are called petitioners. Petitioners may be beaten, arrested, or thrown into jail. According to Melissa Chan of Al Jazeera, who got kicked out of China last year for reporting on this, black jails, or basically secret jails, are holding facilities for petitioners who come in from the countryside. And the only reason they're let go, presumably, is because it's just too expensive to permanently hold them. The Chinese government's biggest fear, in many people's opinion, is instability. It's hard to control 1 billion people, actually 1.3 billion something. So China's top officials hatched a plan in early 2011. They decided to put all the people who don't like them into big groups called special populations of dangerous persons. Special populations get special attention from the Ministry of Public Security. They include drug users and people in recovery, people with mental health issues like depression, and people who are being persecuted using the mental health system, being threatened with being thrown into a mental hospital or given electroshock treatment, as we've seen in other places. The special populations also include human rights activists, ethnic minorities like Uyghurs, Buddhists, and, moving on, sex workers. People with AIDS, lawyers who work for human rights, and lots of people who just end up on the list by accident and can't get their names off of it. The special populations of dangerous people in China are enormous, and the government uses smart cards to track them. So out in the world, when they go to an internet cafe, when they try to check into a hotel or buy a train ticket or a plane ticket, those smart cards follow them. Everyone over the age of 16 is required to carry one. And of course, when people go online, well, the government is already looking over their shoulder, reading everything they read and watching everywhere they go. But unlike some places, people don't just get followed in China. They get beaten, they get kidnapped, they get picked up. Most of the Chinese public health experts that I know have actually been beaten by the police at some time in their lives, probably in the last 5 to 10 years. If you can, raise your hand if you think you would qualify as a dangerous person in China. In fact, that's a lot of people. In fact, the blacklist in China numbers from 30 million to 50 million people. And we know that they're being tracked because we have government documents that discuss them. And the way that they're being tracked, among other ways, is this card. I have better ones, but I'm not sure I could fully mask them in a way that was completely unrecognizable. So this is the one that's on, like, Wikipedia. China's second generation ID card. It's a contactless integrated circuit smart card. All you have to do is hold it near a scanner and it gives up your data. The new ones have your fingerprint in them. Right now, the scanner has to be just a few inches away, but new scanners work from a much farther distance. The card is linked to your file in the national database that has your political beliefs, your HIV status, whether or not you're a drug user or a sex worker, your landlord's address, your parents' names, any politically troublesome nonprofit organizations you may be associated with, and much more. Because people's ethnic groups are listed on these cards, there's this idea that I've at least read about that it actually solidifies ethnic groups in China because you're labeled over and over again. There was a pilot program for these cards in Shenzhen, a city of 10 million people, in which the data tracked also included the person's health insurance status and personal reproductive history in accordance with China's one-child policy at the time. Also in Shenzhen, the police had to wear a GPS on their belt everywhere they went and were also tracked by cell phone signal, just like everyone is now. There's a rumor that the police can scan the new cards from 10 yards away or 15 meters away in China in crowds. So in other words, you can scan by standing in one place at a group of petitioners. And I couldn't find any proof of that. I just saw rumors. And I thought it seemed kind of like 10 years from now. And then somebody pointed out that the United States uses cards with a special meter, a special scanner to scan workers crossing the border back and forth from the US to Mexico. And it has a several meter range. And then that same person pointed out this. EasyPass actually scans you and pays your toll as you go through a highway in the United States. And almost everybody with a car has one of these things. And it's tracking you. And it seemed really innocent at first because it's just a toll tracking thing. And that's when we found out that it's actually tracking you all over the place. There are hackers that managed to hack this thing together where it makes a cow mooing sound every time you get the sensor picks you up. And if you're in New York City, it never stops mooing. So they seem to be tracking people like every few yards. And the idea is that it's for traffic patterns and traffic management. But, you know, the technology is there. And what we've learned when the technology is there is the technology gets used in a lot of different ways. Can you raise your hand if your country requires you to carry an ID card? Wow. And how many of those cards, can you raise your hand again if they're smart cards? And raise your hand if your card encodes your fingerprints. Again, the technology is there. In China, if you want to tweet, you have to register with your national ID number. And most people use Weibo, which is heavily censored in China, because Twitter is blocked. Your personal information is shared among many public ministries. The Ministry of Public Security, the Ministry of Health, the local police, and even like low-level neighborhood watch people have access to, like, you know, your history with STDs and stuff. And this information is used to round people up. For example, on December 1st of this year, which is World AIDS Day a few weeks ago, a group of 200 petitioners living with AIDS traveled to Beijing to plead for a monthly bit of money that they're supposed to get from the government, 100 RMB, I think it is, 100 or 120. They came to protest, and police used handheld scanners to select people from the crowd and detain them. So that was the Chinese government's feel-good story for World AIDS Day, and they made the mistake of it being the first story, so it was actually the image for World AIDS Day in a lot of news outlets this year. And I want to focus a little bit on this special population of dangerous persons, people with AIDS in China. It's just a list of everybody who gets your info. They share the database. So anyway, I'll talk more about it. And this is Henan Province. It's a rural farming area. There are millions of farmers in Henan, and they were the victims of a blood-selling scandal. Over the past 20 years, government officials in the region ran profitable side businesses where they collected and sold blood for transfusions to blood banks. Originally, the government did not want to accept blood from outside of China because they were afraid it would be infected with HIV. So they started to pay people in China to do it. But it isn't something that a lot of people like to do for different cultural reasons. So they started to pay them, and they would give them the equivalent of $5, and they put all the blood into big containers, big vats, big barrels, according to blood type. So one big barrel with type B, another big barrel with type A, and so on. And they didn't test the blood for HIV, hepatitis, anything else. For cultural reasons, they then injected a little of the blood back into the person who had donated it. So if anybody else in the type B barrel had HIV, well, you might get it too. You probably would. It was injected directly into your bloodstream, and that is the most efficient way to transmit AIDS. And the farmers didn't know they were infected. They had never heard of AIDS. Many of them were poor farmers in their late teens or 20s, they eventually got married, had children, didn't know they were infected, whole families, and then whole villages started to die, and they were famously called AIDS villages. And this is how about 100,000 people were infected with AIDS in China. And plan A, the government plan A for dealing with this crisis, was to let the people die off in secret. We have documents that disclose this. But Plan A did not work for the Chinese government because there was a whistleblower. I'm going to show you, here's a picture from a few years ago of the families in one of these AIDS villages. These are people that like farm to eat, so if they can't farm. Here's a baby from one of the AIDS villages. A women's health doctor, a gynecologist, was treating a woman in the region, and she eventually realized that this woman she was treating had AIDS, that she'd gotten it from a blood transfusion when she was giving birth. And then this doctor tested other women for HIV, and all of a sudden she realized that the blood supply in China was not safe. And she gradually traced it back to these blood-selling businesses in Henan, which I think maybe early on didn't realize there was a problem, and then we can see there's like a timeline, and you can see when they realized there was a problem and the fact that they didn't change anything after they realized that there was a problem, which is China is not unique in that situation. Anyway, so this doctor wrote pamphlets about this to spread the word to families, and she gave interviews to very courageous local newspapers who printed information about this, and then the word got out to the New York Times, and it was no longer secret, and the Chinese government was unable to let people just die. They had to care for them a little bit. Here are cemeteries with a lot of recent graves in Henan, and about 40,000 people have already died. This is Gao Yaoqi, the whistleblower. She risked her life to tell people about this epidemic. She is one tough person, one tough individual. She was harassed by the police. She was put under house arrest in her, like, 80s, 70s. But she eventually was freed through the intervention of this woman. Dr. Gao received an award from Hillary Clinton's organization Vital Voices in Washington, D.C. in 2007. To get her to D.C., Washington, D.C., and out of house arrest, the former First Lady intervened on her behalf with Chinese officials. Dr. Gao now lives in New York, reportedly being taken care of by Columbia University graduate students. So sometimes Hillary Clinton supports whistleblowers, and that's an excellent thing. But getting back to the ID cards, these ID cards are used in a number of ways. For example, when the US National Institutes of Health gives money to China, as they often do, to study AIDS in China or, say, sex workers and HIV, China's health department collects the data, enters it into the national database, where the Ministry of Public Security can read it and arrest these people, arrest the sex workers. When drug users check into a hotel, 20 minutes later, there's a knock on the door and the police drag them away. Two months ago, a Chinese journalist wrote something negative about the government, and then later, not much later, went to the train station to buy a ticket, and you use your card to do it, your ID card, which you have to do. And when he entered his ID information, the word petitioner showed up on the ticket monitor, not journalist, which he is, but petitioner. He was actually labeled by the system a protester. And the next day, his microblog account was closed, and he was talked to by the police. So it's possible to label people incorrectly on purpose and use that to suppress their freedom of expression. In another case in the last couple of months, a human rights lawyer used his card, bought a ticket, was just about to get on the train, and was thrown into a van and ejected at his house. So imagine a world where you can't go anywhere in this weird way and you don't know when it's going to happen. Because these things are not at every train station. And nobody knows, or nobody who doesn't run them, knows which train stations they're at. So it's kind of a mind fuck. And you have to self-censor. You're like, maybe I won't go, you know, to wherever, Xi'an. Maybe I won't go here. Maybe I won't go there. And pretty soon you're moving back. You're censoring yourself. So the government doesn't need to censor you. And that's much more efficient for the government. And then, let me introduce you to the big men of China. This is the Politburo Standing Committee. Note the diversity. Just kidding. The guy in the top middle, Li Keqiang, was the governor of Henan Province during the blood-selling scandal when 100,000 people were infected with AIDS. And no one has ever been held accountable. But he was in charge. He was, in fact, promoted several times, and the reason he's on this, in this picture, is that he is now the premier of China as of March of 2013. But we don't know much about him. There's a rumor that each of these guys gets the spoils of a whole corrupt Chinese industry. You get gold mining, you get banks. It would be interesting to know more about the finances of these public officials, especially Li Keqiang, the one with the arrow. These scanners are used to go after people. This is a $100 handheld scanner. It doesn't phone home, it just gets the basic information on the card, name, address, ethnic background, which, when you're talking to the Chinese police, is pretty scary. Here's an even cheaper one, $47. This is my favorite because of the name. This is the Fugitive Finder. It was just approved for use by the US TSA. It can scan your card and check over 100 databases to find out exactly who you are. It was designed by an American company in Port Townsend, Washington, Washington State. The same company makes a buoy-like device that floats in the water and monitors boats coming into the harbor in Washington State for oil companies and the US government. And obviously, it can do it from a distance. It's not up against these boats. Here's another device by the same company in Port Townsend that the TSA would like to use in airports. You can see the little skull and crossbones blurrily there. That means the guy, whoever it was, did not pass the test, whatever, you know, the check. And here is an image of this buoy situation. The person who runs this company is an expert in military intelligence. He also does things that check, makes apps that check people at bars for their ID, and then also one where you download the app and you can record for yourself how much you've been drinking and where you've been, and like where on a map you've been. And I just feel like, you know, what could possibly go wrong with that? Here are things that need to be done, not necessarily by you. Now that I look at the word you, I feel bad about it. But things that are missing. Actually, let me start with what we don't know yet about, or what, you know, the people that I've spoken to, which is a lot of human rights groups and Chinese activists and a bunch of people, don't know yet. We don't know how much information is stored on the card and how much is stored in the national database, because it could be all in the card. We know there's a national database, and we know a lot of it's in the national database, but we don't know how much and exactly what it is. We don't know what kind of encryption is used on the chip. We don't know if the cards are reprogrammable. Like, what if you were somebody else or somebody who didn't exist? We don't know if the card, we don't know how far away they can be scanned. We know that they can be scanned really close, but we don't know what the outer distance is and how, to what extent the Chinese government is using, for sure, using the bigger scanners, the longer range scanners. We don't know who makes the decisions to, say, flag a reporter incorrectly as a petitioner. And there are lots of things that would be useful. One is encryption tools in Chinese that are easy to use. I'm sure everybody is aware of that, PGP. Here's something that would be helpful to a small group of people who are under a lot of pressure. So, sometimes your surveillance is like when you open your front door and there's five cops there and they're just there all the time. And sometimes your surveillance is you don't have to open your front door because somebody's actually living with you, which has happened to a friend of mine. And when that happens, you're kind of right on the edge of kind of being taken away pretty much all the time, especially at this time of year when the back of a lot of different people who would otherwise be get involved, you know, they're busy with the holidays, they're not paying attention. So this is the worst time of year for Chinese activists. And a lot of times they're dragged away in like the middle of the night, and nobody knows where, and the government doesn't have to say where they went for 6 months by law. So you don't know if they're dead or alive or where they went. It would be great if there were something this person could just like slam or, you know, or click or something that would take their picture, maybe the picture of the person who's taking them, and then track them. I know that's, you know, I'm a human rights person. but that would be helpful. And then send a message to a human rights organization that's designated for this, or, you know, a relative even. Activists like myself need to do a better job of preparing for Christmas and maybe doing something like Thunderclap, where you already enlist the support of everybody on a list, and then when something bad happens, you push a button and hell rains down on the people that arrested someone or detained them. And it's good to fund groups that are already smart, that you already trust and respect. And I've done nonprofit work for long enough to be in the situation where you're in a totally underfunded group and a totally well-funded group. And well-funded groups can totally screw up. But if the group is underfunded but really smart, people burn out, and they don't have like the, I mean, these are people that are dealing with the NSA, they're dealing with the Chinese government, they're, you know, they need to have enough money to comfortably like put teams out to work on things because they're up against huge obstacles. And that's basically it. I want to thank a huge number of people. This was a lot of people's involvement. Thank you so much to the Chaos Computer Club, and thank you for having me here. This is an amazing experience for me. Hacker conferences, not my usual area, super exciting. Steph Alarcon, who lives near me in Philadelphia and has spoken at previous congresses, and who has advised me on what to do. Griffin Boyce, who helps make bridges for Tor so that to get people in repressed countries onto tour. John James, a great friend of mine who helped me do research. Reporters Paul Mooney and Melissa Chan. Meg Davis, who's at China Hand, a China expert in Geneva. Privacy Watch, Human Rights Watch, Open Society Foundations. The people in anonymous there, the anonymous sources, not the same as anonymous, would make a fantastic dinner party, and I wish that I could bring them all together because they're an amazing group of people. And feminism, which gives me the guts to stand here. So that's all. Thank you. One more thing. One more thing. This is my first trip to Germany, and as an AIDS activist, I'm so thrilled. This is the Berlin patient on the right. When he was in my city of Philadelphia, he's the first person ever cured of AIDS, and the country that cured him was Germany. So anyway, that's all.
Okay, thank you very much, Kate. It was a very interesting but also kind of chilling talk that you gave from the topic here. Now, we still have time for questions from the audience. If you have questions, could you line up in front of the microphones here? And we also have questions from the internet because this talk is streamed into the internet. And Aprika, or Signal Angel, has one question. Go ahead, please.
Well, the RFID chip got the most attention in the chat, so they all wondered, like, what is about physical errors in your ID card, how is that handled, and, like, are people allowed to use RFID blockers, like, what happens if police can't read your scanners from distance, or, I mean, what happens if somebody uses a microwave to deactivate the chip, are they, like, punished? So there's this whole area got right. Really a lot of detailed questions.
Right. Those are questions that I mostly don't have the answers to. I do know that, I mean, it's hard to get a card to pull apart because you need to carry it all the time if you're in China. So it's hard for me to just borrow one or something. And those are answers that we don't have, that I personally don't have. The people that I spoke to didn't seem to have. We don't really know the exact architecture of the chips in these cards. And therefore, we don't know how to hack them. And so the first thing is, what is the card? Like, what is the card exactly? Understanding the cards better, which means getting a hold of some cards. And the second would be thinking about, I don't know, other stuff.
Plus, this is probably not discussed very openly, the issue in question.
A lot of this stuff is not, like, if this were happening in a lot of countries, you'd just find people that worked on this and they would tell you, and, you know, maybe they couldn't do anything about it, but the information would be there. This is very, very difficult information to get. Either people didn't have it, or one example, I think the person had it and was too afraid to tell me. It's not the same as other countries.
Okay, well, thank you. Microphone number two, up here in front, please.
Yeah, well, more challenge, I guess, than actually a question. You actually already formed the thing, the challenge that now is up to us, which apparently is, there is something really to research in. Those cards still are very worthwhile looking at, I think. But obviously the challenge is, we need to get more than one card to know what's inside those, most likely.
Right.
That's really the question, how to obtain at least 10 cards or so, which
10 cards
should
needed?
Be a basis to figure out what's inside.
I don't think that that's impossible. And I think that the great thing about having this platform and being able to like be here and you saying that is that now people can hear this and maybe they have some cards. No. Thank you.
Let's hope for next year.
Let's hope for next year. Thank you.
Okay. Microphone number four in the center of the room.
Hi. Mine is also not really a question. It's, you said stuff to do, and one of them was get a way to track people who have been abducted practically by the police.
Yeah.
But the whole talk was about one card, which is used to track people. So if Wouldn't it be possible to just use that card and scan the person who's policemen do have to get to have this card the whole time, don't they?
The card has to be, as it's been explained to me, the card doesn't do anything itself. It's like a computer, and forgive me, there are probably 100 people in this room, you know, that know more about this, but my understanding is the card is almost like it holds the data. It's almost like a computer disk that you put into the computer. You need the computer to be able to read it, so that's a scanner of some sort, either the sort of dumb one or the one that phones home or whatever. So I don't know. That could happen, but we would need the police to helpfully scan, and that doesn't feel like maybe that would happen. Is that, am I understanding your question or your comment, though?
Yeah, the comment was, why not scan the people who are getting, use the card against its master, basically, because it is a tracking device. So,
right. Well,
why not using it to track abducted people?
Possibly. There's also this thing that if you're a lost hiker, it sends tweets out, and I don't think we want tweets, and it's not encrypted. But that would be an interesting, like, I wonder if somehow that could be moved into something. And there are bracelets that they've made for this purpose, but, like, without asking, I guess, the right people, because, you know, you don't want someone to try and remove the bracelet the wrong way. But thank you.
Okay, microphone number 2 up here, please.
You've mentioned this list of the undesirable people and how you get on there. I wonder how big a problem just corruption is. So if some police says just pay a bribe or you'll be listed as a drug user, is that a big problem? Or?
I understand that somehow there are counterfeit cards, but I have no other information and I have not seen one. I mean, you can order fake ones, but they're not really fake, and they wouldn't pass a scan. You know what I mean? Like, they're just picture cards. They're not, as far as I can tell.
Now, I wonder if you, what's the danger of being listed incorrectly in this database as, say a drug user, if you just didn't pay a bribe to the police or something?
Possibly. I mean, that's possible. I'm not sure we know who's. I believe that I was told that a lot of people can enter the data, so maybe that's possible. Yeah, bribing someone into change your data. That's an interesting idea.
Okay, more questions from the internet. Aprika.
I'm sorry. So the next question is, do you think our EU and US privacy laws will be sufficient to counter these invasive usage of ID systems, like we started to have some in Germany, for example?
That is a good question. Right now, the United States ID card is a piece of paper that falls apart, and which, until a couple of years ago, I was always mentally criticizing. It's a piece of cardboard, and it falls apart. It's just nothing. It's not even plastic. You don't even have. It's not even encased in plastic. So, I think that I worry that. I mean, our record is not good right now on this. The situation is okay right now. It's fine. It's a piece of paper. But it seems like who knows what the future holds. And I think that one reason that I wanted to do this talk is just to have people keep an eye on this, you know, in the United States and elsewhere. And here in Germany, you have an antenna in your cards, and you can have fingerprint data. And, you know, again, the technology is there. It just, I don't know.
Okay. The lady from the center of the room, please.
Thank you. I'm a student at UCLA, and I was born and raised in China and went to United States 5 years ago. And so right now I live in LA. I have ID card, and since now I'm a US citizen, I don't use it anymore. So if you need it, I...
Makes sense.
This is a great Congress. That is very helpful to know, and now you should say nothing else. But if you want it, of course.
Yeah, I don't have it with me, but, okay. You know.
Maybe we can talk later, yeah. I'm going to go to the noisy square in case anybody else has any, you know, after this, in case anybody else wants to talk.
After. Okay. Good. Up front here, please.
I was just wondering, you said that you wanted a function to track people when they're picked up by police, but when those people are picked up by police, aren't they searched for cell phones and any other types of devices and are taken off them? So this device would have to be very small,
right,
and be able to be hidden, so it wouldn't be an option to just do an app for a smartphone. I just cannot imagine the device that wouldn't be found by police and be so easy to handle at the same time.
Well, one thing that's weird that I don't understand, and probably I just haven't asked the right person, is that sometimes they let you keep your cell phone when you're detained for a while, and like then there are these like weird, I mean, this happens in U.S. protests also, where like, for some reason they've let you, and then you send a series of messages out, and then people all respond to the messages, and then eventually, like 4 days later, your phone disappears for, you know, the duration. But they do seem to sometimes let people keep their phones. I can't even imagine why. It doesn't, I haven't asked, but that's a thing. But obviously, it would have to be really tiny, And that's like a dream thing. I know nothing of the world of making something like that, nothing. So it may be completely unrealistic, but it would be, something tiny would probably be necessary, or something that you can easily pick up and hide or put in your ear or, I don't know. I mean, these are people that literally, they get dragged away, nobody hears from them for 2 years. The stakes are really high, I mean, this is a country that unfortunately, although it has so many wonderful things about it, currently is detaining a Nobel Prize winner. So,
Okay, thank
okay.
you.
Another question from the internet, Aprika.
Yeah, one last question. Chinese people, if they travel abroad, like come to such a congress or something, do they have to take their cards with them, or are they allowed to take their cards with them?
The people that I know, the cards that I've seen, I would imagine that they are allowed to bring them. Other people would probably know better than me.
But do they have to bring them?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think. I don't know. I'm not going to speculate. I'm not sure. Sorry. It's a good question.
And on the other hand, do people traveling to China have to carry a card?
Yes, they do. They need a passport. So we're not talking about passports, we're talking about internal passports right now.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Yes, please.
I think I can answer this question from the internet. Yeah, I'm from China. Here, I don't bring the ID card. Even in China, I don't bring every day. Mm. I live in Beijing for 17 years. I didn't bring the ID card every day with me. Mm-hmm. No police check ID card.
They seem like they are now. They're doing more spot checks. But that's what people have been saying. They didn't used to, but now they are. I don't know why, and I may be incorrect, but that's what I've been told.
Yeah, yeah. And thanks for your research. And for another question about the microblog,
yeah.
In China we can use microblog. I can register an account in the microblog, without ID card.
But with your ID number, right?
Yeah,
you need your ID number.
Without, if you just follow someone to watch, you mm-hmm. do not post anything. You do not need input any ID number. But in several years ago, we can write something without input our ID number.
Okay.
Currently, if you need to say something, write something, you need to input the ID card. But it's very easy for Chinese to search, to use Google to search an ID number from the internet, and you input it into the microblog. So you can still. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. These are great, this is really exciting, great things to hear.
Any more questions from the internet, Aprika?
Who is speaking from the internet? It seems like God. Where is the person?
Up there, right beside the camera. And she has a microphone as well. Okay, no more questions from the room. So that leaves us to wish you good luck for
Thank
your
you.
Struggle and for your cause. And people interested in meeting you can meet you later, where?
At Noisy Square.
Okay,
I don't know where that is. I mean, I don't remember what part of the center it's in, but yeah. It's on the second floor, I think.
Okay. I would have to look it up as well. Okay. Once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.